From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's kind of a theme in the work of Paolo Bacigalupi, where he imagines these dystopian societies in the future, though they're not as far off in the future as some writers put them, and they're not nearly as far-fetched. Bacigalupi is interested in what kinds of industry or societies fill the void of spent resources. His latest book will resonate for those of us in the West because the scarce resource at the heart of this book is water. What happens if the very real drought in the West persists? What if the water of the Colorado River slows to a trickle? How would we all respond? What would the West look like if we all got desperate? Today in the program, we're talking to Paolo Bacigalupi about his book. It's called The Water Knife. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a chilling image in Paolo Bacigalupi's new novel where he imagines the West in the not-so-distant future where the old order around water has broken down and a new one has taken its place. It's pretty scary, the new one. He mentions Moab in this image I'm referring to, which caught my attention for obvious reasons, but it, he says, could be any city in the West, Tucson, Grand Junction, Delta, where the lack of water always ends up the same. And here's the image in his book, as he puts it. Traffic lights swinging blind on tumbleweed streets, shadowy, echoing shopping malls with shattered window displays, golf courses drifted with sand and spiked with dead stick trees. And it's true, really. That's what would come of many cities in the West if they didn't have any water. But the real disaster in this scenario, Bacigalupi says, isn't just climate change and a persistent drought. It's how people react to it and how people neglected to see it coming. Paolo Bacigalupi is coming to Utah this week, and today on the program he's joining us to talk about his new novel. It's called The Water Knife. We invite you to join us if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number, and our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Paolo Bacigalupi is a science fiction and fantasy writer. He writes young adult and adult novels, including The Wind-Up Girl and The Doubt Factory, among others. As I mentioned, he'll be in Utah. He's going to be a guest of the King's English Bookshop. We'll give you details a little bit later. Bacigalupi lives in Colorado, and he's joining us today from NPR member station KVNF in Paonia, Colorado. Paolo Bacigalupi, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
I wanted to begin with your experience in Colorado. You grew up there on a small farm, and you've described your parents as hippies who wanted to get back to the land. And I wanted to sort of have you start there because I'm wondering what influence growing up on a farm, albeit kind of a progressive farm, I guess, how that influenced the way you've been thinking about water, because water is such an issue for people who farm.
Right. Well, okay. So, yeah, my parents moved out to the western slope of Colorado in the 1970s, and they were very much the idealistic hippies who wanted to get back to the land. They wanted to grow organic food, all of that kind of stuff. Growing up on that farm, that meant that I was aware of the water cycle, I think, in ways that you aren't normally aware of water cycles when you live in a city. By the by, my parents were actually terrible farmers, and they failed miserably at what they did. But the idealism is not enough.
Right.
But you know, growing up on that farm, it meant that you know, you were aware of the water cycle in a really visceral way. From where I lived, you could look up at the mountains and you could see how much snow there was. You could see whether it was thick with snow if everything was covered, or you could see if it was melting very quickly. You could see you could go just a few miles up the road to the dam that stores all of the water for our irrigation. We can see the canal that runs right behind our house and that we tap in order to water all of our fields and orchards and things. And so you're aware of that entire set of connections. And in a good year, it means that your water runs into your fields all the way until October. And it's amazing. And you can grow for a long time and you have a lot of prosperity. In a bad year, oftentimes what will happen is that around July, somebody with a higher water right than you will put a call on the river, and your irrigation canal immediately gets shut off, and all that water has to flow downstream. And so you also grow up with a strong awareness of how water rights work, and junior water rights get cut off before senior water rights. And so it's a very interesting thing to see that there's water in the river, but that you aren't allowed to touch it anymore because somebody else more important with a better water right gets it instead. And that makes an impact on you. I think when you're growing up, you pay attention to those things.
At what point did you start to I mean, you've written about these, I don't know if dystopian is actually the right word, but you've written about societies and human nature that is dealing with these future issues or issues of in a future, not so distant future in many cases. Bioengineering, of course, and the wind-up girl and genetically modified food and Shipbreaker as a novel, a young adult novel that talks about the end of oil and and sort of how – so I'm guessing water's the third in this sort of sequence, if we want to put it that way. So how are you thinking about all of that?
So a lot of times what I sort of describe my writing is I think of it as writing either accidental futures or broken futures. Huh. They're the futures that we didn't want but we ended up with because we failed to plan or failed to anticipate in some way.
Right.
And so with the Wind Up Girl, I was really interested in what it would mean if large agricultural companies controlled all the food, and how they would run things for profit, and what kind of future does that create? And in Shipbreaker, what happens if cheap energy runs out and we don't find a way to bridge to other energy technologies? What happens to the world? How does it break? And then now with the water knife, it's very much that question of, oh, there's this resource, which turns out it's fundamental to our prosperity. It's fundamental to our lives in a way that almost everything else isn't. You can't go for more than a couple of days without water. And yet it's also this invisible resource. We take it for granted because it's because we've built such a wonderful engineering system essentially to make sure that water gets where we need it, when we need it, when we want it, so that when we turn the tap, it's there. So when we turn the tap, it's clean enough to drink. There's a lot of know-how that's behind that set of systems. And yet it's also amazingly vulnerable. And the thing that really got me thinking about this was years ago. I remember reading I used to work at a newspaper called Hind Country News.
Yeah.
And there was a journalist named Matt Jenkins who was doing reporting on the Colorado River. And he was talking about how Lake Powell was low and they weren't really thinking that it was going to refill anymore. It was always going to be lower than full. And that was sort of an interesting thing. And later, there were other stories about how Lake Mead was also low and how Las Vegas was, putting out deeper and deeper intakes into Lake Mead. They were essentially first extending pipes and then drilling deeper into the bottom of Lake Mead. Right now they're working on intake number 3, which might be done by now. I'm not quite sure, but they were essentially drilling almost into the bottom of Lake Mead so they'd be able to pump even as the water level gets lower and lower. And when you're thinking about the accidental futures, one of these ones is like, well, wait a second, what is this telling us? Mm-hmm. If this water supply gets lower and lower, and that's the trend and that's the pattern, what does that mean? Where are we going? How does that work out? And so that was sort of the leaping off point for writing about water, was seeing those trends and sort of also seeing that we were treating that information with a big yawn.
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, I've heard you talk about the fact that you had this argument. Maybe this was your boss at the time who said, look, human ingenuity will figure this out. We're clever creatures, and we will be able to find a way out of this problem. And you kind of pushed back on that idea. And I'm wondering if that's what you're hearing now. Like, yes, okay, so Mead is low and Lake Powell is low, but we're smart people. We can work around this.
Right. I mean, that's sort of the techno-optimist's sort of sense of humanity is, hey, whatever comes at us, we're ingenious monkeys. We will solve this thing.
Right.
And on some levels, that's really true. I mean, humanity is capable of amazing innovations and capable of amazing adaptation. I think that we work better when we are dealing with threats that we understand viscerally. We're much better at dealing with the threat of a Hitler than we are with the threat of a low reservoir. One of those is really, really scary. Oh no, Hitler's coming, right? And the other one is like, yeah, the water's a little low, but boy, it sure is pretty, and I can still put my houseboat out on it.
Right.
So, even the bathtub ring, in a way, is pretty. In Lake Mead or Lake Powell, like that beautiful white ring. You've got the beautiful blue water, the beautiful blue sky, the red rock, and the white ring. It's all very nice. I mean, it's picturesque. That doesn't stimulate visceral fear. That doesn't stimulate the kind of, oh, we need to solve this right now, response that you often need. By the time we get to something like the California drought, people suddenly are running around like their hair is on fire, saying, "Oh my goodness, like this, we're vulnerable." But I think that the danger is that with many of these infrastructure problems, by the time you're running around with your hair on fire, it's really too late. You need to be looking at these problems much, much sooner. And that's not something that humans are wired for. And so you do sort of have this feeling that even though we're innovative, we can miss the boat on when we needed to start innovating. So that's part of it. But the other thing I think about innovation and techno solves essentially is that we often tend to solve the wrong problem. We oftentimes will go for the quick fix rather than the long-term solution. And so, when we're looking at something like drought in California or drought generally in the United States and our vulnerabilities to it, one solution would be to run around and try to create a whole bunch of water-saving technologies, which we absolutely will do, and we will change our legislation and stuff. But, there is this other step that we could be taking, which is that we could tax carbon so that we don't usher in a climate change future that makes these droughts deeper, worse, and more awful. And so there's the source of the problem, and then there's running around sort of trying to fix the symptoms of the problem. And with us, normally we do techno fixes on the symptoms rather than the source.
It gets us to the way you write about how corporations have filled into the void, which we'll come back to that because I want to sort of lay some groundwork here first. There is this moment early on in the novel where all of these people are flying over the Colorado River in this helicopter.
Right.
And I promise, Paolo, I'm not going to give too much away.
No, I'm not worried.
Tell me if I get too close. So,
Okay.
And I won't. But I think it's early on enough in the novel, so we're not giving anything away. But they're flying over this helicopter. And there's this kind of beautiful moment where, even though they're in this dystopian future, desperately squabbling and fighting over water, they fall silent over the Colorado River
Right.
at the sight of so much water. And you talk about even now as the and we'll, when the river is running low, that it's still awakened, as you put it, reverent hungers. Would you talk about that? Because it seems like there's this sort of primal connection to water that you're writing about, certainly at this moment.
That moment. This is a moment very early on where a bunch of Nevada Guardies are National Guard people are flying literally in a bunch of military choppers to go blow up a water treatment plant, and so they're all about getting the job done. They're not the sentimental types at all, and yet as they approach the Colorado River, there is this reverent moment where this is what not only what they're fighting over, but this is the thing that, I mean, when you think about water, the saying is that we carry the oceans inside of our blood, that when we came out of the ocean, we carried the ocean with us. And that's, an interesting idea is that we are, whatever it is, 95% water, in our blood and our cells and our bodies. And that's an extraordinary thing to think about, is that we are deeply connected to water. And I think we've all had experiences when you're out in wilderness where you come across those large bodies of water or where you find that waterfall, that there is something astonishing and deeply powerful, sacred about those spaces that are both natural and lush with water. That's where things grow. That's where life happens.
What are you imagining the Colorado looks like in this, again, not so distant future? Because you write about it at the river running low and sluggish at this point. Like, compared to the river, you know, how are you conceiving that? How did you draw it up? What it looked like at this point?
I'm imagining it running just at a much lower level, but also that it's been dammed and held back and everybody's sort of pulling more and more from it. And mm-hmm. so it's sort of the anemic trickle that it used to be. But it's also that spot, that one lifeline that runs through, you know, 1,000 miles of desert. It's the spot where trees can still grow next to it and where birds and insects are there and thriving. I think of it as this sort of last remnant of something vast and great. But it's also something that's being changed radically. At this time in this near future, California is busy investing in piping great mm-hmm. pieces of the Colorado, and Las Vegas is investing in a huge sort of carbon fiber cover to encase Lake Mead so that they can sort of prevent all the evaporation from happening. So it's becoming a more and more technologically controlled thing, even as it's you know dwindling.
There's this scene early on. I'm glad you referred to it because I wasn't sure whether to mention it. But the fact that they bombed this water pumping facility does show you sort of where we've gotten in this future.
Right.
Talk a little bit about this because it helps illustrate how extreme things are. So you have Las Vegas getting this legal ruling, and a lot of this really turns on these legal rulings on water rights, which is something that you think about as so crucial to the West. But in this particular moment, Las Vegas gets this ruling that goes in their favor, at least temporarily anyway. And so they seize the moment to bomb this
right.
water pumping facility in this place called Carver City.
Right.
Explain how extreme things are. I mean, again, we're dropping bombs on a water facility in the United States, one
right.
state doing it to another.
Right. And this is, you know, this is a future where, through, you know, a sequence of natural disasters, through droughts, through hurricanes, the federal government has become more and more taxed and overwhelmed with its attempts to deal with the problems that are sort of coming up. And at the same time, you know, the states have started sort of taking more and more power for themselves. And so there's a really robust sort of states' rights movement happening where the states are – the power is distinctly devolving down to the state level. And all the states are starting to look at each other in a very different way. And so – and everybody's kind of testing the boundaries of what they can get away with. What will trigger the feds to say, no, we're still a United States and we still actually are united in some way versus no, we're actually fragmenting and you're too weak to stop us from fragmenting and taking care of our own interests. And so everybody's testing what's legal and what's not. What can you get away with? What can't you? As the scarcities have gotten worse and worse on the Colorado, Las Vegas has employed every tool in its tool chest to make sure that it has enough water. And so one of the things that it has is water knives.
Right.
And the main character of the book is Angel Velasquez, and he's a water knife. And he's the guy who goes out and gives somebody an offer on their water rights that they can't refuse. And he's the guy who goes and blows up someone else's water treatment plant when they have a favorable ruling. And fundamentally, it's one of those things where they've all concluded that there isn't enough for everyone. So let's make sure we get ours. And that's sort of the world that Las Vegas is functioning in, where they're very clear-eyed about making sure that they get theirs.
This is so interesting how you managed to decide in this book you're writing who would be the winners and who would be the losers. Because it's interesting being from Colorado, living in Colorado, as you do.
Mm.
You know, Colorado, first of all, isn't that crucial a player in the story necessarily. Mm-hmm. And Colorado and Utah are kind of losers in the scheme of things. They're not really allowed to have access to the Colorado River water in the way that they did in the past. So
right.
Phoenix is the big loser. Las Vegas is the big winner. least in this scrum. So how did you decide to pick the winners and the losers as you're sort of formulating this all out?
So there were sort of a couple of layers. One of them is I'm really interested in how water rights work on the Colorado River Basin and how the upper basin states like Colorado and Utah are required to send water down to places like Arizona and Nevada and, of course, would give 4 million acre feet of water to California.
Right.
And that's an interesting thing that, you know, that the senior rights on the river are held by the guys at the bottom of the river, California. And so, you know, when you're thinking about the future and how that plays out, I definitely was thinking in terms of my own experiences growing up of watching water go by and not being able to touch it. But the other thing that I really thought about was that I'm really interested in how people think about the future and how they plan for it and how they anticipate it. And my working theory is those people who are most reality-based and most clear-eyed will tend to be the winners in the future. And with Las Vegas, one of the things that I noticed is that Las Vegas over the years, even though they have terrible, terrible actual water rights, they only have rights to something like 300,000 acre feet of water out of the Colorado. Even with that terrible water right, they've managed to thrive. And they've done that by doing everything from putting out water bounties on lawns to make sure that nobody's growing any lawns to, you know, to investing in going deeper and deeper into Lake Mead to suck out the water, to forging agreements with the other states that for every gallon of water that they put back into Lake Mead, they can pump another gallon out. So they have been more aggressive about how they cycle water in and out of the Colorado River and how they recycle. And in all those cases, they've been, you know, pretty aggressive about it. And they've also been, you know, pretty aggressive about sort of mentioning to everybody that they're perfectly happy to take this all the way up to the Supreme Court and see whether or not some other distribution of water might turn out. And that, you know, that's kind of kept the other states in many cases sort of back on their heels, allowing Nevada and Las Vegas to really sort of set some of the agenda in terms of making sure that Las Vegas has the water it needs. And that seems like a very clear-eyed sort of like, you know, reality-based sort of way to go about things here now in the present. And so when I look towards the future, I sort of said, okay, so let's make that society the one where they just keep doing that, but even more so. They're even more aggressive. They're even more serious. So there's a version 2.0 and a version 3.0. And by the time someone like Catherine Case is running the Southern Nevada Water Authority, you know, they're it's no holds barred. They're going after water wherever they can, and they make it happen.
And I'm not quite sure how to ask this part, but for those of us who in the West who are familiar with the players in the current water picture,
right,
we may see some resemblance between Catherine Case and Patricia Mulroy.
Oh, absolutely.
So for more than 25 years, for those who don't know, Patricia Mulroy, you know, was the general manager of the, I think it's called the Las Vegas Valley Water District.
Yeah, or the Southern Nevada Water Authority.
That's it. And she incredibly powerful, incredibly influential. Pretty litigious, not unlike Catherine, generally held with respect, but also with disdain for her aggressive style.
Uh-huh.
So is she a kind of a Patricia Mulroy?
She's kind of a hero for me. Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, she is Patricia Mulroy 4.0. Yeah, absolutely. I've always been hugely impressed with Patricia Mulroy because she inspires, you know, hatred, fear, anger, but she gets the job done. And that's, you know, when you're talking about a bureaucrat, that's exactly the kind of bureaucrat you want working for you, the one who gets stuff done.
Smart. I mean, as she is, anyone who knows who's interviewed her, she's intimidating because she's so clever and so smart and so clear-eyed, I think is the way to describe her.
Strategically clear-eyed. Yeah, absolutely. And that, I think that makes a huge, it made a huge impact on me as I've watched stories about her, as I've watched stories about Las Vegas. That definitely stood out. And then as far as, you know, losers, one of the things that's always struck me about Phoenix has been how cheap their water is and how sort of absurd their location is.
You mean in the heart of a very, 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 very dry desert.
Yeah. And that they managed to get this massive subsidized water sort of pipeline built, this canal, the Central Arizona Project built, for their sort of personal use is amazing to me, that Arizona has this subsidized canal that literally have to pump water not only uphill, but over 300 miles in order to get it where it's going. That always struck me as being sort of sort of hubristic, I guess, to think that we could engineer our way to prosperity in the middle of a desert that way. So I decided that Phoenix would sort of represent a sort of the opposite of Las Vegas, that it would be the city that tried to whistle past the graveyard and hope that bad things weren't coming, that climate change wasn't real, that mega droughts weren't going to be a concern for them, and as a result, they've suffered terribly in this future.
Paolo Bacigalupi is with us. His new novel is called The Water Knife. This Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock, he's going to be giving a reading at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. We have details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take a brief break, and we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Paolo Bacigalupi is joining us to talk about the dystopian world he's conceived in his new novel. He imagines a West in the not-so-distant future where places like Moab and Tucson and Delta have become ghost towns because their water's been cut off. A lot of Bacigalupi's work explores the scenario where climate change or genetic engineering are pushed to the extreme. In this new book called The Water Knife, he imagines what would happen if the water in the Colorado River really did begin to dry up. And what if the drought really persists? How desperate would people get? How would they behave? Again, the book is called The Water Knife. He's coming to Utah to talk about it. He'll be at the King's English Bookshop on Wednesday. We'll give you the particulars about that as we go along. He's joining us today from Paonia, Colorado, member station KVNF. There. And Paolo Bacigalupi, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned the High Country News. That seems like, I don't know, I mean, the first version of this book was The Tamarisk Hunters, if I got that right, as a short story, which appeared in the newspaper. And it seems like that newspaper had a kind of a profound influence on you, because one of the main characters in this book is an environmental journalist.
Right.
Is that true? Were you influenced by the environmental journalists like those who work there in Paonia?
Deeply, actually. Yeah, I used to work for High Country News as their online editor. And so what it meant was that you were constantly in contact with these journalists who were going out and writing stories about, you know, they could be writing about water scarcity or water rights, about water politics. They were writing about the landscape. They were writing about Matt Jenkins was doing a lot of work at that time about water. Michelle Nyhaus was starting to write a number of stories. She's a fabulous journalist, and she was writing a lot of stories about climate change and how we were. And this is back in 2005 or something. And already we are seeing certain landscape changes. You know, slow alterations in the way that sort of the landscape and the ecosystems were adapting to climate change already, or changing in response to climate change. And it was really, I mean, it's a really fertile space where lots of interesting news tidbits are kind of constantly coming across your desk. And you start to see context, and you start to see a landscape that's otherwise invisible without science journalists and reporters like them. You can kind of bumble along without having an understanding of how many things are happening all the time. So there's that, which is just powerful. And it's ended up informing almost all of my writing, actually. And those writers, I joke that I let someone like Michelle, you know, go out and do all the research, and then I can just steal it and turn it into fiction.
Right.
They are excavating the shape of the future right in front of us, if we only would pay attention. But then there were other people like Greg Hanscom, who was the editor there, and he really wanted me to play around with a story that took what, you know, people like Michelle and Matt were writing about and try to give some context to that. If you're a responsible journalist, you can't say where we're going. You can say what's happening now. That's reasonable as a journalist. That's responsible as a journalist. But for me as a fiction writer, I can play around with that extrapolation. I can say, well, I looked at these pieces of data, and I can ask that question. If this goes on, what might the world look like? How would that feel? What would it be like out there? And then I can give a reader a visceral experience of that. And And that was the Tamarisk Hunter. That first story was all about water already being scarce on the Colorado River and a man being paid in water bounty to tear out tamarisk and cottonwoods and Russian olives and anything else that might suck any water from the river. And in return, California, which owned the rights, would give him a little bit of water bounty so that he could keep watering his small farm. And that was the beginning of an experiment with writing about water and the environment, and specifically because of High Country News. It had a huge impact.
When did you conceive of Lucy Monroe? She's this journalist,
right?
Really at the center of the book, obviously. And she has. I wanted to ask you about this because she has become known for her work. They call it collapse porn.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that, because this is a really interesting part of the story.
Okay. So Lucy is this very well respected journalist who spent the last 10 years down in Phoenix documenting the collapse of the city as its water rights have sort of failed it, and its reservoirs and backups have failed it. Phoenix has started to fall apart, and in fact, it's in the process of collapsing more and more quickly. And she's been around to document that collapse, and the things that she gets rewarded for, where she gets the most hits, where she gets the most income, where she gets the most eyeballs and attention, that all comes from her writing about sort of the salacious details of devastation. Mm-hmm. And I was really interested a while ago in how we do photographing of places like Detroit, yeah. where we love to take pictures of the old ancient buildings that have now become sort of jungle-like or, you know, shattered. And, you know, sort of these ruins are really fascinating to us. But you know, there are still people actually living in Detroit. And so there's this weird... there's this weird quality of like our focus is on the ruins as opposed to the people. And Lucy is very much involved in that same kind of thing. She's writing collapse porn. She shows the dirty details of a city falling apart. And yet that she feels frustrated by that because she wants to write stories that are more in depth. So if she does a big investigation about corruption in water management, that gets almost no hits and no value from the general public, but you know, it might win her an award, but it doesn't get any real public attention. The stuff that gets public attention is show me some more suffering, show me some more hurt, show me some more like tragedy. So there's that going on in the story, and that was something that you know also we saw at. Working at High Country News was that you can only tell so many sort of wonky bureaucracy stories or even depressing stories before people sort of tune out and sort of, want to step away. We used to get letters from people saying, oh, I'm so sorry, I have to cancel my subscription, but I'm just too depressed by the stories right now. I just can't take it. And they were very apologetic, and sometimes they'd send extra money. They're sort of tithing, you know, for the fact that they couldn't stand to pay attention anymore, that they'd much rather read something a little happier. That's a human impulse. I mean, I have that same feeling. You know, when I'm going through the news articles, which am I going to click on? Am I going to click on something about, you know, Carly Rae Jepsen, or am I going to click on something about, somebody starving in Africa or whatever? You know, we have choices about where we focus our attention. And of course, we focus towards pleasure rather than pain.
Well, it seems like there's this kind of it's like a Steinbeck book, but set in the future in some way, at least where you – and it seemed like this is a decision you made, not unlike the, you know, fictional decision that Lucy makes. And that is to not just talk about – climate change and the effects of climate change in this really academic way, but to say, here are the refugees of climate change. And here
right.
are the – I mean, Maria seems like the perfect illustration of that. Here's a real life affected like that, and here's what happens to a human being in the wake of all of this.
Right. One of the things I think is really interesting about fiction is it's one of those spaces where we can build empathy. It's the space where we get to live inside of the skin of somebody who's completely different from us and experience their world, their needs, their dreams, their hopes, their fears. And I think that's, you know, that's the superpower of fiction, and I really, and I value that. Yeah, there's a point where you can write as many academic papers about climate change as you want, you can file as many news stories as you want. That doesn't give you a deep lived-in experience of what this might mean for us. And so writing about Maria, so Maria Villarosa she's a refugee from Texas, actually. In this future, Texas has been devastated by droughts and by hurricanes, and
they got their way, we should say. They're a sovereign state now.
Right? Exactly. Yeah, no, they were very, very, it's all Texas until the moment when they're desperate for some place to go, and everybody wants to get out of Texas, and everybody's like, no, you stay there.
Yeah.
And so Maria has actually, in this future, Maria has managed to flee to Phoenix, and then she's been trapped there by a whole bunch of state border control laws that have gone into effect, where the states have sort of erected their own militias in order to keep climate refugees from overwhelming them and flooding them. And so she's sort of washed up in Phoenix, unable to go further north. And all she wants to do, she desperately wants to get to some place where rain still falls from the sky. And that's an impossible dream for her at the moment when the story opens. She's trapped in Phoenix and trying to figure out any way she can to survive. And that, you know, the opportunity there is that we get to live inside of her skin. We get to see how hard it is to live with barely any water at all. Get to feel worried for her because water is so expensive, and at market price, water is extremely expensive in Phoenix. And you sort of see her going through, you know, all of her decisions as she tries to figure out, like, what do I need to do to survive, and how hard do I have to fight in order to do it, and how, you know, sort of cheated out of her future she's become because other people sort of set her up to fail long ago, you know, because we in our present, you know, set up the failures that then she has to live inside of.
It's so interesting, too, the way in Maria's case and in some of the other characters, this balance of power has shifted in the world. You know, the workers are all paid in Chinese yuan, for example. And
right.
Immigration has shifted too. I mean, the dynamic around immigration has shifted. I mean, the Chinese now have become admired by people like Maria's father, for example.
Right.
Because they build, they get things done. And it's not America that is the sort of the leader in that view.
Yeah, no, and that's going back to this idea that, you know, who's going to be clear-eyed about the future, who's going to be investing in it, who's going to invest in infrastructure, who makes things happen. And so in this future, yeah, America has spent a great deal of time sort of, you know, giving up on the idea that government can do anything, giving up on the idea that it needs to invest in infrastructure, giving up on the idea that it needs to plan. And in some cases, just simply being in denial about where the future is going. And in this future, China has been very clear-eyed about that and has made a lot of plans. And I mean, you can see that in the way China handles its, you know, how it handles its politics on something like the Mekong River, or how it handles going after territory in the South China Sea. You know, China is, you know, not... They're pretty clear-eyed about what they need. And so in this future, yeah, China has become more and more robust and more powerful simply because they aren't living in denial. And that's a strong aspect. And so by this time, the Chinese actually have invested in certain places. They're investing in the solar fields of Arizona.
Right.
They're the foreign investors who are coming in and sort of generating jobs and some level of opportunity in what has become essentially a third world country, the United States.
Paolo Bacigalupi is with us. His new novel is called The Water Knife. He's going to be here this week on Wednesday, in fact, at the King's English Bookshop at 7 o'clock. He's giving a reading there. You can get details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the writer Paolo Bacigalupi. We're talking about his new novel called The Water Knife. Bacigalupi is coming to Utah. I'll be in Salt Lake on Wednesday at the King's English Bookshop. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. So there are so many interesting elements that I wanted to ask you about. Arcologies. Tell us what an arcology is and where did you come up with this?
Well, so our ecologies are these self-contained cities, essentially. They're places where people live, work, recreate, but they're also super efficient structures for they grow food, so they're southern faces, they're giant buildings that their southern sides are all hydroponics. They're coated with solar collectors and stuff, so they're generating their own electricity and stuff. But they're also they're really efficient with their resources. So every drop of water that comes in, every bit of waste that they generate is reused and reused, so that they're not as vulnerable to the vagaries of supply on the outside as regular cities are. And so the biggest arcologies are all being built in Las Vegas, and so I've envisioned them as these huge structures with interior hanging gardens and waterfalls that are also doubling as sort of their water aeration treatment and sort of recycling systems. But they're so at the very top, there's all sorts of living environments, and there are beautiful, butterfly gardens and things like that. It's like the tropics. In the very basements, of course, are the casinos still bubbling away. And that environment is ideal for taking resources in and using them as efficiently as possible. And that's where anybody who's lucky enough or rich enough wants to live at this point.
Do you see them as being arcologies as being disgusting and unsustainable, or as like this, not this particular option in that particular way, but if again going back to whether or not we're these clever primates, if we could figure something out like that, if we put our heads together.
Yeah, it's again, I think it's sort of the solving the wrong problem. I mean, they're the reaction to the idea that the outside world is harsh and no longer self-sustaining for people. And so the arcologies are all about sort of bringing everything indoors. It's saying that the outside world is no longer that safe and nurturing environment that we all bioadapted from. And so it's sort of a hunkering down, and it's a very much a defensive set of technological solutions to an increasingly harsh environment. I mean, the forethoughtful thing would have been that we all got together and solved climate change instead. And instead, what we've got is the rich people are all hunkering down in their rich arcologies and getting ready for the apocalypse.
Which brings the Mary Perrys. This is a cult you create. I guess a cult is the way to put it, I suppose.
Or religion. I
Yeah,
mean,
yeah.
It's the fine line between clever and stupid, I guess. So, I mean, it's sorry. The Mary Perrys. The Mary Perrys for me were, they were inspired by a trip I took down to Texas. Back in 2011, I was down there, and the drought was happening down there, and it was devastating. It was amazing to see how bad the drought was down in Texas. They were putting their cattle down because the land couldn't support them. Farm crops were never going to grow to fruition. You were seeing rolling brownouts because they didn't have enough water in their reservoirs, and so they didn't have enough water to generate hydroelectricity. And because of that, then everybody's all, at the same time as running their air conditioners at max because they were having record numbers of 100-degree days. And so at the same time that their demand is at its all-time high for electricity, their supply of electricity is actually sort of squeezed. There were just a lot of really scary things going on. And it struck me that most of the things that were happening pretty much matched exactly what climate data says future Texas should look like. So you can realize right at that moment that you're time traveling, right? You're not actually in a drought. What you're doing is you're time traveling. You've just leapt 50 years into the future. Ta-da, here we are. Wow, looks scary. But the other thing about that was that at that same exact time, Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, was and also a viable presidential candidate at that time, he was holding prayer circles, and he was praying for rain. And that really struck me. I mean, that really got me going on this whole idea of like reality says things are going to get worse, and then you say, what does the leadership say? And it says, well, they're praying for rain, which means these guys aren't reality based at all. They're engaged in magical thinking. And that was really, really powerful. And I really wanted to sort of, you know, give Rick Perry a tip of the hat to that kind of magical thinking. And so there's Mary Perrys in the book, and those Mary Perrys spend a lot of time praying for rain, convinced that all of this is simply God's wrath visited upon them for their sins, not something to do with science and carbon and how much gasoline we happen to burn.
There's this moment early on in the book when Lucy is talking to her friend Jamie, and he mentions, right. You know, sort of what you just said. We should have seen this coming in the first place.
Right.
We just watched it happen. And then Lucy says this to him. She says, "We didn't know how to believe." And then this really sets him off. And this seems like an important idea. He challenges this idea that this isn't about belief. This is something else.
Right. Jamie, he does go off on that because, you know, she's like, "We didn't know how to believe that this, you know, bad future was coming." And he was like, "You know, belief is for religion. That's exactly where belief goes. It's the thing that you can't test. But science is the thing that we can test and that we do test. And you never have a belief in science. You have testable theories. And you keep testing them until you prove them. And so this is, you know, this is the schism I think you see in America generally is, you know, what do we believe versus what do we test? And it's the schism between deciding that we're going to engage in magical thinking versus reality-based thinking. And Jamie, he's like, "Wait a second, no, this was not about a belief thing. This was us deciding to ignore testable data." So that's just willful incompetence, essentially, is what he says.
That one of our listeners sent this question about whether or not, I guess what the essence of the question from AE is, whether or not you see this as being something kind of plausible, the idea of there being a battle. I mean, he mentions this documentary where former Utah Governor John Huntsman actually mentioned that if we keep heading in this direction, and he was talking about, you know, sort of giving in to Las Vegas and other really aggressive water users. If we keep going in that direction, you can expect an outbreak of civil war at some point. Mm-hmm. So what do you think? Do you see that as a kind of a potential that we do get that desperate?
I think that our potential for violence upon one another depends on how much humanity we invest in one another. Mm-hmm. And it really depends on whether or not we believe that we are a species and a nation that is supposed to be cooperating with each other and planning together for a mutually agreed upon future. Right now, we have a really, really hard time mutually working together on almost anything. And that paralysis, that, you know, the schisms between Republicans and Democrats, the schisms between states, that paralysis and that inability to sort of seriously look at rational cooperation paths, I think that does lead towards very bad futures. And the longer you wait, the more zero sum we become. I think that, you know, when you want to avert those bad futures, you start cooperating early and you start actually, you know, inculcating the values of cooperation and civic responsibility that would actually, you know, and civic investment.
Yeah.
That would avert a bad future. And so I think that our bad future is entirely dependent on our willingness to be clear-eyed and humane and cooperative today. So I guess it's up to all of us to make that decision.
You know, one thing you've written or you've talked about anyway, when people say, you know, what are you and what are your – I mean, cli-fi is often a word that comes up.
Right.
And science, sci-fi, mm-hmm. Where exactly mm-hmm. do you fit? And I think it is an interesting question because you yourself have said that in many ways you're kind of at odds with a lot of science fiction writers because they have a kind of inherent – maybe faith isn't the right word, but belief in technology, whereas you've even said we need to rethink our techno love. I mean, that using.
Yeah.
Would you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I do think of myself as being a science fiction writer in certain ways because those are the tools I use.
Sure.
You know, the science fictional question, if this goes on, what will the world look like? That extrapolative question is very much, you know, the core of what I do. You know, Margaret Atwood also says she writes anticipations. Mm-hmm. And I really like that as a term. I think the spot where I feel like I'm not in sync with science fiction is that it always is looking for the techno fix. It's very seldom looking for the social fix. And I feel like technology is one of those things, it reflects us no matter what. Technology is a pretty neutral object. You know, and so if you look at, you know, any given piece of techno-solve that we might have, you can see both power and promise. If you look at something like nuclear power, you can see that it can be an electrical generating source, or you can see it as a bomb, or you can see it as a representation of our hubris and lack of foresight when you have something like the Fukushima accident. All of that is encompassed inside of technology. And so, you know, I'm far more interested in us and what version of us we want to bring out, because that's going to define how effective we are with our technologies. You know, as far as, you know, really how I define myself, more and more I've started thinking that the thing that I'm interested in the most is black swans, which are events that are unanticipated by history or unpredicted by history. And that's something that's really, really powerful to me. The idea that we think we know where the story is going. We think we're in control of our future. Mm-hmm. And then something comes in and just sideswipes us. You know, the 2008 financial collapse is sort of a great example of that, where financial experts said, hey, we're all fine. And then, boom, suddenly, you know, the entire world economy is in free fall. And everybody's like, oh, look, that was surprising. Yeah. And, you know, and something like a mega drought also is one of those things. It's like, you know, everybody's like, no, we're pretty technologically savvy. You know, and you hear that again and again, that the United States is rich, we're techno-savvy, we probably can weather the effects of climate change. Whoa, how big a drought will actually undermine that idea? And so those black swans and those question marks that are out there are the thing that I'm most obsessed with. Is I'm worried very much about the surprises that might be out on the horizon that we haven't prepared ourselves very well for.
So when you're writing now, you said something a while back where you talked about how all of our myths now are focused on how to become rich and successful. And you're wondering about creating a different set of myths and a different set of models. And I'm wondering what you meant by that, where you're trying to change this idea of us seeing ourselves as looking at the bottom line and being successful that way, and being a different kind of species where we're thinking more about sustainability. I mean, have you started creating the structure, the myth, the models for those in your writing?
You know, I have, and it's a tough thing, because you want to, there's some things where you want to tell a positive story, right? Because we like hearing a positive story, and that's where our joy lies. Yeah. And you also don't want to create the illusion of a future that we haven't yet earned. But I do think that science fiction has this power to give us these sort of guideposts that we can look out and say, hey, that seems like a smarter direction to go. With one of my novels, Shipbreaker, I wrote about these beautiful high-technology clipper ships. They have high-altitude parasails. They have hydrofoils. They're very fast and they're very sleek. And what I wanted to sort of emphasize was this idea that we could have a global economy that's entirely sustainable. We could base it on wind, and it could be beautiful and powerful. And all it really takes is us investing in that idea and that direction. And so you are sort of looking for ways that you can sort of emphasize those ideas. You know, in The Water Knife, for sure, the thing that I want to emphasize is those people who are clear-eyed and reality-based tend to survive and win. And if you were going to model ourselves for some survival pattern, like, that's where we need to be.
Paolo Bacigalupi, the author of The Water Knife. Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, he's going to be at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City to give a reading and a signing there. Details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Paolo Bacigalupi, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.